Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Today, our guest will be Mike Aponte, a former MIT Blackjack team member and now currently teaching other people to play blackjack or advising existing blackjack teams on how to do it. We'll be talking to Mike shortly, and we're going to mention a few other things first. 3 weeks ago, I told you that Michael Shackelford was seriously ill with a food poisoning with a significant chance of non-survival. I wrote in the script the following week the follow-up, and several people have said, you never told us what happened to Mike. So I'm going to tell you what happened to Mike. He's alive and well. He's about 95% recovered. He is at home. He lost about 20 pounds, which on many people would be a good thing. Mike was pretty lean to start with. So he needs to gain some of that back and his strength back. So if ever I'm going to beat him in arm wrestling, I better do it quickly, because when he's at full strength, I have no chance. But anyway, he's well.
But did you collect the money he owed you from the Super Bowl bets?
I did mention that he owed me some Super Bowl bets, and I collected most of it, and I'm not worried about the rest. It happened he paid me in tickets, which would be you take a ticket to the window and they'll pay you. So some of the Super Bowl tickets obviously won. And so I got a combination of cash and tickets. And then he was still sick, so I went around to various casinos and collected. One of the tickets was he accidentally gave me a losing ticket to try to cash, and for some reason the casino didn't cash. So it's about $700 that he still owes me, and neither one of us are worried about it. But the vast majority I got. The Tropicana here in Vegas is closing their poker room, and that's happening in several places. What do you know about this, Munch?
Nothing really. I just saw an article that I guess 8 poker rooms have closed. So, they're wondering if the whole poker boom is over, although now that the internet gambling is coming, that may start it all back up again. But
it was definitely the internet boom that started it, and TV started it. So,
but on the other hand, the majority, for the way the law is now, you have to live in Nevada to play online poker. So this may actually really hurt the existing poker rooms, because a lot of the players will be staying at home to play online rather than coming out to fill up the games in the casinos. So
I don't know. Munch and I had dinner before the show tonight, and he was asking me on behalf of a friend who's moving to Vegas from some other state, and so is planning on keeping his out-of-state ID and getting a Nevada license.
Right. We had talked before that there are some casinos that it's better to be a local, and some casinos it's better to be from out-of-state. So I was asking you which and why.
So I haven't prepared anything specifically to go through, but off the top of my head, in Vegas, and my viewpoint is video poker, which is so table game may be different, but in Las Vegas, the local casinos, which include South Point, Palms, Stations, Coast casinos, so generally give weekly mailers to local players, and they, when an out of town player goes to them, they get a certain amount of cash and a free room and stuff. But the amount of cash they get once a month is generally less than what they would get if they came in 4 times for with a local ID. So if you're signing up for a card at a local casino, it's probably better to be a local. If you're planning to play at strip casinos, the big one, the big advantage to being an out-of-towner is you can get airfare. Airfare, if you plan it right, can be collected on the same, four times on the same trip, easily.
And yeah, but I mean, so, but for the smaller players, they would probably still be better off than being locals because they would get mailers.
Yeah, but well, smaller players basically have no reason to play on the strip, at least in video poker. Video poker on the strip, it's a technical term, but generally it sucks. So
right, if, but table games, they would have reason to play table games on the strip, and table games players get mailers too, so.
The comps for table games is nowhere near what it is for video poker players.
Yeah.
But good. So there are good table game opportunities on the strip.
And just so for people to be aware, you know, if you have a passport, there's no ID, there's no address attached to it. So you can be from anywhere you want to be if you sign up for your player's card with a passport instead of using a driver's license.
That's right. So when you sign up, you just happen to have left your driver's license in your other wallet, and here's a passport, and
yeah, or I don't drive, here's my passport. So and you know, by the same token, if you are a player who is after airfare, you might want to use your New York address rather than your Los Angeles address when you sign up.
That's true. It is bigger airfares.
Yeah, I actually one time was collecting airfare one morning at a strip casino, and the shift boss happened to come by, and the host introduced him, and he looked at my airfare, and he said, $1,600 from L.A.? And I said, you don't expect me to fly coach? And he just kind of laughed and, you know, shoved it back to me. He said, what, did you have a stopover in Paris? So, but they gave me the money.
Well, and the correct answer is, yeah, it was Philadelphia, but yeah, we did. So, yeah, there are people who have been known to abuse airfare.
You know, they've been getting much, much tighter with all that stuff, though, so it's a lot harder to get that than it used to be.
It is, in some respects. It would mainly be physical tickets. And so I once saw a physical ticket where a casino might rubber stamp it, paid by the Golden Nugget. And you try to take that to Caesar's Palace, and they see that, ain't going to happen. They're not going to pay it again. But now on the internet, you can print off as many copies of your ticket as you want.
And actually, if they like you, if they really like you as a player, they don't even – I've had them not even ask to see the ticket. They're just like, how much was it? Okay, that's fine. And they give me the cash, and they don't even ask to see the ticket.
Depends on the casino.
And how much they like you and how much they think you lost.
Right. And the casinos that are part of big chains tend to have more of a dot the I's, cross the T's mentality because it has to be reviewed several levels up. At casinos that are standalone casinos where they can make their own rules, then they aren't frequently as nitpicky about that.
It also depends on the strength of your host. You know, some hosts can do more than others. So
that is definitely true. All right, let's talk to Mike Aponte. He is a member of the MIT Blackjack team, was a member of the MIT Blackjack team years ago. Other members of that team that have been on this show would be John Chang, Lori Chang, although we call her Lori C on the air.
Andy Block.
And so they have been on here. So now we'll gradually get the whole team someday. So we had a recent interview with Nathaniel Tilton, who wrote a book called A Blackjack Life. And Mike Aponte was a key member of starting Nathaniel out. And then later when Nathaniel and his partner got going, they went for some fine-tuning instruction from Michael Ponte. So, Michael Ponte, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
All right. So how did you happen to get onto the MIT Blackjack team?
Well, it was a completely unexpected and random event. It was my senior year at MIT, and one day a really good friend of mine told me about this card counting team at MIT. So at that time, I had no clue what he was talking about. I didn't know the first thing about blackjack or card counting. Now, at that time, the team was an actual legal entity, Strategic Investments, which I'm sure you guys are familiar with. So It was an actual startup. And so that was my introduction to card counting. And that was the predecessor to the later teams, the bringing down the house team, for lack of a better term, that had went on to have great success.
That was the team in the movie 21 as well.
Which is based on that book.
Now,
yes.
John's take on that was that the book was half true and the movie took the half out that was true. What was your feeling about the movie?
John Chang's description it's pretty on. It was funny, when the book first came out, we were not happy about it, because as you guys know, advantage player, community discretion is one of the golden rules. And so even though the team was no longer playing, it just felt strange for our story to be out there. And I didn't become any happier once I actually read the book. There was a good amount of artistic liberties taken, although looking back on it now, it certainly did a much better job of capturing the story than the movie. I think Ben Mezrich, the author, he captured kind of the general timeline. He moved things around, and he certainly did take some fabrications in the story. But overall, it was an entertaining account of what we accomplished. Now, with the movie, on the other hand, that was really Hollywood.
So you didn't meet in strip clubs after a play, huh?
I can only recall one weekend. It was a weekend we were fortunate enough to win $500,000 over a Super Bowl weekend in Vegas, where we actually did, a group of us actually did go out on the town, Crazy Horse 2, as I recall it. But we were completely done playing for the weekend, and I think $500,000 was justification to have a little bit of fun. So we had a good time, but it was actually not too crazy by Vegas standards.
I only made $500,000 one night, and my wife definitely did not want me to go to a strip club that night. So, oh well. So were you ever, when you were playing, were you ever backroomed by a casino?
Actually, I was backroomed once, and most people would think it would be in Vegas, since that's where we played most often. But actually, I managed to avoid getting backroomed in Vegas. The place where I ended up getting taken to the back room was in Louisiana, in an Indian casino there. And that was probably the most nerve-wracking experience of my professional blackjack career. Well, it was a new casino for us, so I had arrived with several teammates, and as you guys know, when you first come to a property, you kind of scout it out, do your reconnaissance, so to speak. And I had been there for only about half an hour, and when I looked up, I was suddenly surrounded by six security guards. So it was pretty well orchestrated, because as Munchkin can attest to, typically there's some warning signs, but they just kind of sprang on me. And I noticed they were really hostile and angry. You know, of course, when management and security comes down to back you off, they're not going to treat you with too much politeness, but they just had a different, much different and more severe tenor to their demeanor. And they ordered me to come with them. And unlike previous times when casinos had tried to backroom me, when I had resisted and stated what my rights were, I went with them, because I knew that if I did resist, they were gonna drag me or maybe even pummel me. So I get to the back room, and they also did this exact same thing to one of my other teammates who I saw across the pit. They put us in separate rooms. They ordered me to empty out all my pockets. So it was about $70,000-$80,000 in cash, you know, sitting there on this table. And then the casino manager comes in. And that's when I found out why they were so angry. For some reason, which to this day I still do not know, they suspected me of using a computer to gain an advantage at the game. And that's when I knew it was a completely, this was a very serious situation. Because there I was in rural Louisiana on an Indian casino, which, as you know, is technically a different sovereignty, and I stood accused of a major felony. So I feared that this thing could go sideways really badly. And
But you'd have to have a computer on you, right? I mean, if there's no computer, I mean, I don't, you know, I mean.
Doesn't that end the case?
Exactly. I mean, that's why it kind of boggled my mind. So when it just defied logic, but when someone, when there's such a major oversight, then I got kind of scared. You don't know what's going to happen at that point. Because exactly, I thought, how could I possibly be using a computer? You searched me. I emptied my pockets. You know, there's telltale signs if you're using one. But
did they ask you to take off your shoes?
They did. I took off my shoes. And so for the first and only time in my career, I actually told the casino exactly what I was doing. I said, look, I was counting cards, yes, but I wasn't using a computer. I was just using my head. But the casino manager, he didn't look completely convinced, and so he told me to wait there. And so they left me in this room with these two burly security guards who were kind of staring me down. And after about, you know, 10, 15 minutes, the casino manager returns, and he had this kind of half grin on his face. And I wasn't sure if that was a good thing or a bad thing. And then he extended his hand for a handshake, and he said that everything was good, that I was in the clear. And so I let out a huge sigh of relief.
I'll bet.
And then that's when it got really bizarre. I was just ready to get out of there, but then they tried to become like my best friends. Like the surveillance manager came down and
they wanted you to play there in their casino?
No, well, not to that extent, but they said that, because this was getting towards the latter point of kind of our heyday. So the MIT team was, its existence was pretty well known in the casino surveillance world. So the surveillance manager came down and told me it was an honor to meet me, that he'd heard a lot of great things about the MIT team. And he actually even asked for my autograph. And
Did you charge him for it?
Well, this was well before the book came out and the movie, and I'm usually a pretty accommodating guy, but I did sign, but I thought, wow, this is crazy. So, and then actually they took a few pictures with us too, like snapshots. And
well, yeah, but that wasn't because they liked you. That was to post it somewhere, I would guess, in the surveillance monthly.
No,
news.
these were like standing together smiling, right, with the surveillance
exactly.
guy?
Yeah. Yeah.
Not like mugshots.
And so it was a kind of surreal ending to a very stressful night. So after we accommodated them on these requests, we were finally able to get out of there.
Did you try suing?
For what?
For being taken to the back room.
Well, I think, you guys, as you guys know, that'd be pretty tough given that it's tribal territory.
Huh.
Are you guys aware of any Advantage players that have successfully sued for being detained on tribal land?
Actually, I am not. That's a great question next time we have Bob on.
Good question. He's referring to Bob Nersessian, who is one of the best lawyers for gamblers.
Have you ever sued a casino?
I haven't, no.
But the MIT team has. Or, I mean, on.
Or members. Have, certainly, yeah.
I think, as far as I know, do you know if. I'm not aware of John Chang or.
Well, Lori certainly has.
Lori has, but Lori was married before. And Richard Chen, I think. And he had a Burmese passport or something that he was using for.
Yeah, well, that was Richard's suit, but Lori but has that
was,
her own.
But the, yeah, but that was also. But he was a member of the MIT team at the time, wasn't he?
Oh,
yeah, yes, yeah. That was with respect to the confiscation of chips that he had won using a camouflage passport. Did Lori's lawsuits have to do with being detained?
Well, her latest one is she went back after she received an invitation to go back in the mail, and so she went back and then got arrested, and so that's what her current lawsuit is about.
And it's still pending.
Oh, but I guess that was after the MIT team. That was,
yeah, it was
that
after.
Was later, yeah. Anyway, so talking about confiscating money. Have you had other situations where money got confiscated?
There was one occasion where it was actually on a trip to the Bahamas. So actually earlier in the year, myself and one of my teammates had made a trip to the Bahamas. It was a really successful. I think between the two of us, we won about $80,000. Didn't have any problems. Then a few months later, one of our newer players, he was a spotter prior, but then he passed our big player checkout. And he was a part of the West Coast contingent. And so, he was very excited about passing and wanted to start playing. And he'd heard about our trip to the Bahamas, and he thought, wow, that would be a great destination. And he wanted to go with his wife, who was also a spotter on the team. Now, initially, I had some reservations. He was very, very sound technically as far as his card counting skills, but he really did not have an ideal look for a big player. But group.
Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Well, he looked.
I mean, all MIT team members look Asian, or
I mean, no. The good ones make good BPs do, but. If he looks nerdy with a pencil protector and a Band-Aid on his glasses, that's not a good look for a card counter.
Uh-huh.
Well, you guys are right. I mean, being Asian, even if you do look nerdy, is just a tremendous advantage. And there's no doubt that that's what really enabled me, a big part of what enabled me to play for so long. But this big player I'm talking about, now that you pointed out, he actually was Caucasian. He wasn't Asian. But that's not to say that you can't have, obviously, successful Caucasian big players. But he was, one, he was short, which in and of itself isn't going to eliminate you. But then you combine that with the fact that he wore glasses, and he just had a very intellectual look combined with a very passive demeanor. So you kind of put that all together, it doesn't exactly match that stereotype of a high roller. Well, he did go on the trip with his wife spotting for him, and he won, I think the first night he won about $30,000. Fortunately, the casinos caught on to him, and that's when the casino in the Bahamas, they brought the police in on it. And so the police were playing the parts of the good cops. They were trying to make peace and smooth things over, and they told him just to simply give the winnings back and he could go. Well, when he refused, they turned on him, and they threw both him and his wife in jail. And they not only confiscated the winnings, but also the trip bankroll that he had brought in the beginning. So we ended up losing about $70,000, And for those guys, they had to spend a night in a foreign jail, which I can't imagine was too pleasant. And it's not a shocker that after that trip, they never played for the team again.
By their choice.
By their choice, exactly.
Now, were you able to recapture this money, or is it gone forever?
We did make attempts. We had a lawyer in the Bahamas that was supposedly working on our behalf, but nothing ever came of it.
That just made $70,000 turn into $80,000.
Exactly.
Now, you talk about big players. Do you ever have experience with famous or celebrity big players, like a movie star or a quarterback or a star, a basketball player who the casinos know is a big roller, and then somehow you train him and all of a sudden he's one of your guys? And have you done anything with that?
Well, I think after the book and particularly the movie came out, of course the story became very public and card counting was sort of in vogue. And I did have occasion to meet some celebrities and pro athletes who are very interested in learning. So some of them received private training from me, and a few of them wanted to take it further and wanted to actually kind of join forces, so to speak. But that turned out to be quite a frustrating experience.
In what way?
Well, these guys are just, for the most part, they're a different breed. They're on the complete opposite end of the spectrum from guys like from us, advantage players. And so very simple things like I just assumed for them to learn basic strategy was a no-brainer. But
we didn't even attempt to go that far. I mean, we also tried to do this, and our idea was to just make them gorillas. All we were going to do was teach them, you know, this is a signal how much to bet, and this is hit, stand, double or split, you know. But the problem we came across was these very wealthy and famous people, they're busy, and it all sounds great, but then what do you mean I have to come to a practice session? And then they just don't show up, and, you know, and it takes you a week to get a hold of them again, and then they have some excuse. And for us, it was just an exercise in frustration. It just never panned out. It's great in theory, but for us, it just never panned out.
And our experience was very similar, but I wasn't aware. So you actually, how long ago was it?
Oh, for me, this was back probably 20 years ago. And we had access to some very, very, very big names, you know. And like I said, there were a couple of them that, thought, oh, yeah, this would be great, you know. But then trying to get them to show up to practice and, you know. It just never worked.
Did it ever work out for either one of you that it was successful and that the celebrity big player did work out?
Not for me. Not for us.
Mike?
Not for us as well. I mean, I think Munchkin's experience and my experience just show you that, you know, human nature doesn't change. And just to echo what Munchkin said, it's, yeah, basically they see the movie 21 and they think they can just show up
yeah,
and, you know, win, you know, a couple $100,000 in a few hours and walk away. And one of the big problems we had also was they would just sometimes get bored.
Yeah, because sometimes they're waiting around for, yeah.
Blackjack is a boring game, as is video poker. So, like, you, to be a successful advantage player, you need to put up with a lot of boredom.
And actually, I'll tell you another story that happened to another group, a friend of mine, where they recruited a guy, and he was very wealthy, so he was putting up the money. They won a very large amount of money, mid six figures, and then when it came time to chop up the money, he was like, what do you mean? I lost. After he had played for them, he went and played craps and lost more than he had won. You know, and he, you know, it was like, as far as he was concerned, he was negative for the trip, you know, so you have to deal with that kind of stuff as well.
Well, that just goes back to their true nature. Exactly. They're gamblers.
Right.
And there, it's, you know, I like to believe everyone can change, but most people can't. I mean, it's just, and the fact that they do have money and celebrity and ego, if you think about it, that makes it even less likely that they're going to change.
Yeah.
So what are you doing? I mean, the MIT team was a while ago. What are you doing in the blackjack world today?
Well, these days I'm doing, I provide instruction through classes and primarily private coaching for people who want to learn how to play blackjack professionally. During the MIT team days, I did much of the recruiting and training, and it was something I really enjoyed. And I think for a lot of people that are interested in learning how to count cards, there's a really big chasm between, you know, knowing how the system works, because you can explain to someone how card counting works in a couple minutes, and it's very easy to understand, but it's quite a different thing to actually be able to execute it. And what makes card counting, you know, such a tricky thing is there's no feedback. Like when you hook a when you slice a golf ball or you mishit a tennis ball, you know right away, and you try to make correction. Whereas if you're off on 10 by the count, you have no clue.
If you think it's plus 3 and it's really plus 1, then there's nobody knows.
Exactly, no one knows. There's the dealer doesn't know. There's no reference point. And I know this all too well because in our training with the MIT team, and I know Munchkin, you've experienced the same thing. We'd see players make those mistakes all the time, but that was the purpose of the training. That's when you want to make those big mistakes where someone flips the sign, the count's -7, and they flip it to 7 because they get distracted and they're talking. Now they're off on the count by 14. Or, you know, we've stacked the shoe for training purposes with low cards in the front. The count's gone up to 23, and they'll drop the count to 13 when they get distracted. Those things, even with kind of from the MIT community, that was really common, and it was fine because you want to make those mistakes with no real money on the line and in an environment where your progress is being monitored and tracked. And so that was really, I think, the big key to our success was our training. It's just, you guys know card counting's been around for 50 years. We didn't invent anything of it. We just became very good at executing it. So we really raised our training standards much higher than they were on strategic investment.
Well, the other thing that you have to offer is, I've said for years that it's easy to learn to count cards. It's hard to learn to get away with it. And, you know, I can't tell you how many people I talk to that they read a book, they learned to count cards, and they went out and came to Vegas and went to the double decks and started playing using a player's card. And within 3 months, you know, they're in all the databases and they're barred everywhere, you know, because they didn't know how to go in and actually make any money using, you know, counting cards.
Exactly. There's just the finer points of, and that is a really good point you made. Really common mistake is you have the anxious new, you know, aspiring card counter will rush to double deck games, which, as you guys know, very easy way to get your name out there if you don't know what you're doing. And even simple things like dealing with identity, you know, player
right.
cards, and it's, I'm surprised at the things that, you know, when I work with certain clients that they never even thought of, things that it's kind of common sense for us, but like, for example, just keep your cash, keep your cash transactions to less than 10,000. So I've worked with clients who, during their whole gambling careers, I guess the few times they were fortunate enough to win, they would cash out everything at once. And I didn't understand that. It didn't really make any sense to me. But, there's always, like you said, it's to have success, you have to blend the science with the art. Although I'm a big proponent, I think the stronger your technical skills are, that's going to really help you master the art, because you're just going to have that much more mental resources and energy to be aware and to dedicate to other things, and you know, to do something as simple as to talk, you know, to your casino hosts or other players while you're playing.
If somebody wanted to find out more about instruction from you of various sorts, how would they go about doing that?
Well, they can get more information at my website, which is, it's pretty simple. It's just my name, mikeaponte.com. So they can get information there, and they can also contact me through that site as well.
So Aponte is an unusual name. So will you spell that for us?
Aponte is spelled A-P-O-N-T-E.
All right, mikeaponte.com. Now, you say the training of your people was what set them apart. That's undoubtedly a large part of it, but they were MIT students, and you have to be, you're not, a low-level genius can't get into MIT. You got to be pretty smart. So that has to help. They can memorize numbers better than somebody with an average IQ.
But I don't think that's the main thing. Do you, Mike? I mean, to me, it's really more about motivation and discipline and how hard someone's willing to work.
I think you nailed it on the head. That's the one of the most common questions I get asked by people who are interested in learning, is what is the most important factor? And it's simple. It's your commitment. Being comfortable with arithmetic, and you know, you can't have a math phobia. A phobia of numbers and be good at card counting. But from my experience, you know, people that I have worked with, the ones that have done well, I knew right from when I first met them, because they were focused and their mentality is, this is something that I'm going to be committed to. I'm going to put in, you know, the work. I'm going to put in the time and not try to take any shortcuts. So, yeah, I've seen people be extremely successful who probably they would have had a very tough time getting into MIT. And at the same time, there are many people from MIT who I didn't consider recruiting, because there's much more that goes into it, especially when it comes to high stakes advantage play. There's the street smarts aspect, and then also just being able to deal with pressure. I mean, we've had players that look great in the checkout, but then when it came time for the casino checkout, where they would get watched at starting at a $25 unit, $100 unit, $250 unit, they would just crumble under the pressure.
I had a friend like that. He couldn't bet the money. His hands would shake, literally shake, trying to put out a $500 bet. Couldn't do it.
And for you and me, that's just, it doesn't make sense, because yeah. That's what we
They're
work
just this
for.
Round, color little things.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's I like to think, well, with respect to card counting, that once you get really good at it, in a sense, you're not ever really making a decision. The cards make all the decisions for you, as far as the basic and obviously the true count. And yeah, your job is just to be the driver of that system. Yeah, there were some people we had who I thought were going to be great, but then when it came time to even put out, you know, $300-$400, which isn't that much money, they just couldn't take it. One guy in particular I remember said, he goes, I'm really surprised, but I don't think I'm cut out for it, because I just feel like they're watching me and I'm doing something wrong. So all the mathematical ability in the world, it's not going to do you any good unless you can put out the money when you have the advantage.
Although those players could still be used as spotters, and they don't. I mean, they're just flat betting the table minimum.
That's true. That's a good point, and that's why there definitely was a difference between the big players on our team and the spotters. I think both in terms of, you know, physical appearance or persona, but a big part of it was just kind of the mentality. Because when we first started up again, we had five really gung-ho big players, and we really all did have the mindset that, you know, we were going to win on every trip. And I think when you have that type of attitude, I think it manifests itself in all the little things. Whereas we did have some players who passed exact same checkouts and training, but over time their performance significantly lagged. And I don't think it was a coincidence that they were the ones that tended to have kind of more meeker personalities, because I'm sure you've seen it, Munchkin. It's amazing how some players can just start rationalizing things when they're playing.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe I can bet a little bit less, or, you know,
it's not so bad. I'm playing back here on the crowded table, you know.
Now,
yeah, exactly, because they don't want to, you know, they don't want to move around as much. But yeah, all those little things like a mobile spotter. That was one of the great things about Lori. She was our most efficient spotter. And granted, she had some natural advantages over other spotters. One being a cute, you know, harmless looking Asian female. you can do things that other players can't. But yeah, she was constantly moving. It's all about taking the best possible option. So
I want to ask you about her, because she, when we talked to her, she talked about how there was a big East Coast-West Coast rivalry, and that the West Coasters were just focusing on counting cards and calling in BPs and winning the money, and the East Coasters were making all these advanced plays, gathering CE, but not gathering any dollars. So I'm wondering, were you an East Coaster or West Coaster, and what was your take on all that and the advanced plays?
I was an East Coaster, and what Lori's referring to is strategic investments. It wasn't the second time around. But yeah, that actually is a good segue to one of the big reasons why strategic investments failed is the team, the management got really enamored with the advanced strategies like shuffle tracking, ace tracking, card steering. The problem was that we didn't really, with the exception of John Chang and card steering, because John is excellent at card steering, but with the ace tracking and the shuffle tracking, we didn't have anyone on the team who had actually been really successful at it on their own, and that was really reflected in the training and the checkouts for those types of skills. They're very cookie cutter, like, This is the shuffle. This is exactly how it's going to be. But as you know, Munchkin, it's one thing to know what a casino shuffle is, but most dealers are not going to do their splits perfectly, take their picks perfectly, you know, riffle perfectly. It doesn't take much to throw, you know, to change from what you perceive as being a big advantage to a big disadvantage. Whereas, obviously, with card counting, there's nothing the dealer can inadvertently do to prevent you from counting cards. So
on your teams now, do you focus strictly on card counting, or have you moved on to some of these other things?
Well, we have looked at some other things, but, I mean, the card counting...
Or no comment is okay, too.
I mean, card counting is always... it's a nice foundation, because it's... going to be the most widely available opportunity, and it's a good introduction into advantage play.
I agree.
I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I agree. It's to me, it's, you know, it's the first rung of the ladder. You know, it's you know, you have to take that first step, and
most people who try don't make it to the first step.
Right, that's true.
Exactly. I mean, talking about not making the first step, let's take it to that first mini step. Most of the people that come to me for private training or classes, I estimate most of them don't even, they never even learn basic strategy.
Right. That's exactly what I do when people ask me to learn. I tell them, go learn basic strategy. You know, 9 out of 10 never come back. The 1 out of 10 does. I ask them 3 questions, and it shows me they didn't learn basic strategy, or at least not perfectly. I go, come back when you know it, you know, and that's usually it. They don't.
Yeah, I remember having a conversation with Tommy Hyland a while back, and I imagine this is still his same approach, but that's when he would have a new potential crew. He would just hand them a basic strategy chart and say, learn this, and yeah, come back to me when you have it down. And that was, I found that is really a good litmus test, because the people, some people I've worked with, the big differentiating point are the ones that have just simply mastered basic strategy.
It shows a level of commitment.
That shows a level of commitment, and then it's also a momentum builder. Like, once you get learn something, master something, then naturally you want to go on to the next step.
Thank you very much, Mike. We're going to do some commercials and things. We may have time at the end, and if you can stay on the line, we have another question or two for you. But right now we need to take a break. So this is MikeAponte.com, and thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Very good. The South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anyone else. During the month of March, there will be a $400,000 March Money Madness Progressive. The Progressive will start at $10,000 and continue progressing 24/7 until it hits, which must be before $25,000, when it'll be randomly awarded to any active slot club player, which includes video poker players. Every player playing when the jackpot is awarded receives $25 in free play. Immediately thereafter, another jackpot will begin at $10,000 and start to climb. This will happen over and over and over again during the month, so the more you play there, the more chances you have to collect. Next weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, March 7th through 10th, there will be 4 virtual NASCAR races each day, 6:30, 7:30, 8:30, 9:30. To qualify, you need to play 100 points in the hour prior to the drawing. At the announced time, you choose one driver from its either 8 or 10, I don't remember, and the virtual race is played where you'll see it on your machine. Whoever selects the winning driver receives an equal share of the $5,000 that is awarded for that race. Last time they did this, the prizes averaged about $60 each time, so a 1 in 8 chance means $7 or $8, 1 in 10 chance means $6 EV. For that hour, there are many games that are positive 24/7 there, and so it is a little bit extra. If you smart players there do not do all their play on double point days, and so if you're going to do some play on another day, to keep from being flagged as doing only play on double point day, then that would be a good time to do it. Sunday, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, there will be a double point day. Wouldn't surprise me that the following 2 weekends, Palm Sunday and Easter Sunday, become double point days as well. Wouldn't surprise me either way. It has not been announced yet. Sometimes they announce it late in the month. So stay tuned. The free video poker class beginning at noon this coming Tuesday will be 9-6 Bonus Poker Deluxe. This game is quite similar to 9-6 Jacks or Better, except 2-pair pay single money instead of double, and 4-of-a-kind pays 80 for one rather than 25 for one. It's a 99.64 game, which represents a good gamble on multiple point days. It's also a good class for beginning players. At the Palms, between now and March 10th, which is Sunday, 10 days from now, they're continuing their bingo promotion for both video poker and slots, going on 4 days a week, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday. This isn't actually bingo, but rather a 5x5 card where you mark off squares for getting various hands, like 4 kings, or a full house, or a royal flush, or a certain number of points in a day. The most lucrative card percentage-wise is a 25-cent, 25 and 50-cent video poker, which adds almost 1% to the EV for quarter players and about 0.5% for 50-cent games. Multi-line games are limited to triple play, five play, and 10 play. Among many players, so if you're playing this, play for the Royal of 6,000 coins. And because by the time you get the Royal, you basically will have filled out the other ones as well. If you hit the Royal where you still have something left, switch to a strategy of a 4,000 coin Royal. There are significant restrictions, so make sure you read the back of the card before you play. The PEW gifts, Play, Earn, and Win, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, for the first half of the month will have a theme of home, sweet home. The top gift is a $100 gift card to Sports Authority. You also can win or earn a vacuum cleaner, barbecue pit, clock, and other prizes. Halfway through the month, the theme will be Light Up My Life, where the top prize is a $100 gift card to Lowe's Hardware. You can also earn toolbox, fake fireplace, kitchen clock, among other gifts. At videopoker.com, if you're listening live, you have 4 more hours to play in their monthly contest, which this month features 10 Play Ultimate X Video Poker. The best time to play during this contest is Double Double Bonus, which gives you more chances for getting lucky. If you're going to be dealt 4 aces, which is a good thing to do in this contest, you want to be playing a game where it scores the most. In Jacks or Better, 4 aces gives 125 coins per hand. At Double Double, it gives you 800 or 2,000. And so you have more better chances to win on Double Double Bonus in this contest. Next week, we're going to do back to roulette. We had a couple months ago Mark Billings on the show talking about roulette. And now a friend of Mark's named Lawrence Scott has a different approach to winning at roulette. Munchkin is a believer. So we're going to be talking to him. He has a couple books and we'll be talking about those.
Right. His book is the only book I'm really aware of about professional visual roulette prediction. So the name of the book just flew out of my mind. So, but he'll be here next week, and we'll talk about it.
And
his
in
book.
2 weeks, Barry Meadows, who took a 3-month trip around Nevada 15 years ago, stopping at every place they had blackjack in the state, and he had lots. It's a funny book, and a lot of interesting stories there. Okay, Mike Aponte, are you still on the line?
Yes.
That's the right answer. All right, we got about 1 minute. Now, in the movie 21, they had one of the checkouts was this. They would take them to this Chinese illegal club somewhere in Boston to check them out under live fire. Did anything like that really happen?
Well, we actually didn't take people for an actual checkout in an underground casino, but I know exactly where the author got his inspiration for that. That was from when myself and a couple other members of the team went to this private party for Chinese New Year's. It was a friend of ours. And when we arrived, we were shocked to see they actually had blackjack. And, you know, of course, the advantage player in us just kicked in. Pretty much everyone was betting $5, and they were providing it. It was real money, but they were providing it for fun. But we quickly managed to get the table matched.
Thank you, Mike. We are out of time. Go out and hit Royal Flushes, everybody. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.